Chapter 15. Intelligent, my man, he informed me pointedly that his name was Mr. Senior, and walked off to his hotel, I suppose. Shadows. Shadows. I think I saw a white whisker as he turned under the lamppost. It is a shock to think that in the natural course of nature he must be dead by now. There was nothing to object to in his intelligence, but a little dogmatism maybe. And his name was Senior. Mr. Senior. The position had its drawbacks, however. One wintry, blustering, dark night in July, as I stood sleepily out of the rain under the break of the poop, something resembling an ostrich dashed up the gangway. I say ostrich because the creature, though it ran on two legs, appeared to help its progress by working a pair of short wings. It was a man, however, only his coat, ripped up the back and flapping in two halves above his shoulders, gave him that weird and fowl-like appearance. At least, I suppose it was his coat, for it was impossible to make him out distinctly. How he managed to come so straight upon me, at speed and without a stumble over a strange deck, I cannot imagine. He must have been able to see in the dark better than any cat. He overwhelmed me with panting entreaties to let him take shelter till morning in our forecastle. Following my strict orders, I refused his request, mildly at first, in a sterner tone as he insisted with growing impudence. For God's sake, let me, matey. Some of 'em are after me, and I've got hold of a ticker here. You clear out of this, I said. Don't be hard on a chap, old man, he whined pitifully. Now then, get ashore at once. Do you hear? Silence. He appeared to cringe, mute, as if words had failed him through grief. Then bang! Came a concussion and a great flash of light in which he vanished, leaving me prone on my back with the most abominable black eye that anybody ever got in the faithful discharge of duty. Shadows! Shadows! I hope he escaped the enemies he was fleeing from to live and flourish to this day. But his fist was uncommonly hard, and his aim miraculously true in the dark. There were other experiences, less painful and more funny for the most part, with one amongst them of a dramatic complexion. But the greatest experience of them all was Mr. B., our chief mate himself. He used to go ashore every night, to foregather in some hotel's parlor with his crony, the mate of the bark Cicero, lying on the other side of the circular quay. Late at night I would hear from afar their stumbling footsteps, and their voices raised in endless argument. The mate of the Cicero was seeing his friend on board. They would continue their senseless and muddled discourse in tones of profound friendship for half an hour or so at the shore end of our gangway, and then I would hear Mr. B. insisting that he must see the other on board his ship. And away they would go, their voices, still conversing with excessive amity, being heard moving all around the harbor. It happened more than once that they would thus perambulate three or four times the distance, each seeing the other on board his ship out of pure and disinterested affection. Then, through sheer weariness, or perhaps in a moment of forgetfulness, they would manage to part from each other somehow, and by the planks of our long gangway would bend and creak under the weight of Mr. B. coming on board for good at last. On the rail his burly form would stop and stand swaying. Watchman. Sir. A pause. He waited for a moment of steadiness before negotiating the three steps of the inside ladder from rail to deck, and the watchman, taught by experience, would forbear offering help which would be received as an insult at that particular stage of the mate's return. But many times I trembled for his neck. He was a heavy man. Then with a rush and a thump it would be done. He never had to pick himself up, but it took him a minute or so to pull himself together after the descent. Watchman. Sir. Captain aboard? Yes, sir. Pause. Dog aboard? Yes, sir. Pause. Our dog was a gaunt and unpleasant beast, more like a wolf in poor health than a dog, and I never noticed Mr. B. at any other time show the slightest interest in the doings of the animal. But that question never failed. Let's have your arm to steady me along. I was always prepared for that request. He leaned on me heavily till near enough the cabin door to catch hold of the handle. Then he would let go my arm at once. That'll do. I can manage now. And he could manage. He could manage to find his way into his berth, light his lamp, get into his bed A, and get out of it when I called him at 5:30, the first man on deck, lifting the cup of morning coffee to his lips with a steady hand, ready for duty, as though he had virtuously slept 10 solid hours, a better chief officer than many a man who had never tasted grog in his life. He could manage all that, but could never manage to get on in life. Only once he failed to seize the cabin door handle at the first grab. He waited a little, tried again, and again failed. His weight was growing heavier on my arm. He sighed slowly. "D-end that handle." Without letting go his hold of me, he turned about, his face lit up bright as day by the full moon. "I wish she were out at sea," he growled savagely. "Yes, sir." I felt the need to say something, because he hung on to me as if lost, breathing heavily. "Ports are no good, ships rot, men go to the devil." I kept still, and after a while he repeated with a sigh, "I wish she were at sea out of this." "So do I, sir," I ventured. Holding my shoulder, he turned upon me. "You, what's that to you where she is? You don't drink." And even on that night he managed it at last. He got hold of the handle. But he did not manage to light his lamp, I don't think he even tried, though in the morning as usual he was the first on deck, bull-necked, curly-headed, watching the hands turn to with his sardonic expression and unflinching gaze. I met him 10 years afterwards, casually, unexpectedly, in the street, on coming out of my consignee office. I was not likely to have forgotten him with his "can manage now." He recognized me at once, remembered my name, and in what ship I had served under his orders. He looked me over from head to foot. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "I am commanding a little bark," I said, "loading here for Mauritius." Then, thoughtlessly, I added, "Andy, what are you doing, Mr. B.I., he said, looking at me unflinchingly, with his old sardonic grin, "I'm looking for something to do." I felt I would rather have bitten out my tongue. His jet black, curly hair had turned iron gray. He was scrupulously neat as ever, but frightfully threadbare. His shiny boots were worn down at heel. But he forgave me, and we drove off together in a hansom, to dine on board my ship. He went over her conscientiously, praised her heartily, congratulated me on my command with absolute sincerity. At dinner, as I offered him wine and beer, he shook his head, and as I sat looking at him interrogatively, muttered in an undertone, "I've given up all that." After dinner we came again on deck. It seemed as though he could not tear himself away from the ship. We were fitting some new lower rigging, and he hung about, approving, suggesting, giving me advice in his old manner. Twice he addressed me as "Why, boy," and corrected himself quickly to "Apton." My mate was about to leave me to get married, but I concealed the fact from Mr. B. I was afraid he would ask me to give him the berth in some ghastly jocular hint that I could not refuse to take. I was afraid. It would have been impossible. I could not have given orders to Mr. B., and I am sure he would not have taken them from me very long. He could not have managed that, though he had managed to break himself from drink too late. He said goodbye at last. As I watched his burly, bull-necked figure walk away up the street, I wondered with a sinking heart whether he had much more than the price of a night's lodging in his pocket. And I understood that, if that very minute I were to call out after him, he would not even turn his head. He, too, is no more than a shadow, but I seem to hear his words spoken on the moonlit deck of the old Duke : "Ports are no good, ships rot, men go to the devil." XXXV. "Ships!" exclaimed an elderly seaman in clean shore togs. Hips and his keen glance, turning away from my face, ran along the vista of magnificent figureheads that in the late 70s used to overhang in a serried rank the muddy pavement by the side of the new South Dock. Hips are all right. It's the men in 'em. .50 hulls, at least, molded on lines of beauty and speed, hulls of wood, of iron, expressing in their forms the highest achievement of modern shipbuilding, lay moored all in a row, stem to quay, as if assembled there for an exhibition, not of a great industry, but of a great art. Their colors were gray, black, dark green, with a narrow strip of yellow molding defining their sheer, or with a row of painted ports decking in warlike decoration their robust flanks of cargo carriers, that would know no triumph, but of speed in carrying a burden, no glory other than of a long service, no victory but that of an endless, obscure contest with the sea. The great empty hulls with swept holds, just out of dry dock, with their paint glistening freshly, sat high-sided with ponderous dignity alongside the wooden jetties, looking more like unmovable buildings than things meant to go afloat. Others, half-loaded, far on the way, to recover the true sea physiognomy of a ship brought down to her load line, looked more accessible. Their less steeply slanting gangway seemed to invite the strolling sailors in search of a berth, to walk on board and try, or a chance with the chief mate, the guardian of a ship's efficiency. As if anxious to remain unperceived amongst their overtopping sisters, two or three finished ships floated low, with an air of straining at the leash of their level headfasts, exposing to view their clear decks and covered hatches, prepared to drop stern first out of the laboring ranks, displaying the true comeliness of form which only her proper sea trim gives to a ship. And for a good quarter of a mile, from the dockyard gate to the farthest corner, where the old housed in hulk, the President drill ship then, of the Naval Reserve, used to lie with her frigate side rubbing against the stone of the quay, above all these hulls, ready and unready, 150 lofty masts, more or less, held out the web of their rigging like an immense net, in whose close mesh, black against the sky, the heavy yard seemed to be entangled and suspended. It was a sight. The humblest craft that floats makes its appeal to a seaman by the faithfulness of her life, and this was the place where one beheld the aristocracy of ships. It was a noble gathering of the fairest and the swiftest, each bearing at the bow the carved emblem of her name, as in a gallery of plaster casts, figures of women with mural crowns, women with flowing robes, with gold fillets on their hair, or blue scarves round their waists, stretching out rounded arms, as if to point the way, heads of men helmeted or bare, full lengths of warriors, of kings, of statesmen, of lords and princesses, all white from top to toe, with here and there a dusky turbaned figure, bedizened in many colors, of some eastern sultan or hero, all inclined forward under the slant of mighty bowsprits, as if eager to begin another run of 11,000 miles in their leaning attitudes. These were the fine figureheads of the finest ships afloat. But why, unless for the love of the life those effigies shared with us in their wandering impassivity, should one try to reproduce in words an impression, of whose fidelity there can be no critic and no judge, since such an exhibition of the art of shipbuilding, and the art of figurehead carving as was seen from year's end to year's end in the open-air gallery of the New South Dock no man's eye shall behold again. All that patient, pale company of queens and princesses, of kings and warriors, of allegorical women, of heroines and statesmen and heathen gods, crowned, helmeted, bareheaded, has run for good off the sea stretching to the last above the tumbling foam their fair, rounded arms, holding out their spears, swords, shields, tridents in the same unwearied, striving forward pose. And nothing remains, but lingering perhaps in the memory of a few men, the sound of their names, vanished a long time ago from the first page of the great London dailies, from big posters, in railway stations and the doors of shipping offices, from the minds of sailors, dockmasters, pilots, and tugmen, from the hail of gruff voices, and the flutter of signal flags exchanged between ships closing upon each other, and drawing apart in the open immensity of the sea. The elderly, respectable seaman, withdrawing his gaze from that multitude of spars, gave me a glance, to make sure of our fellowship in the craft and mystery of the sea. We had met casually, and had got into contact as I had stopped near him, my attention being caught by the same peculiarity he was looking at in the rigging of an obviously new ship, a ship with her reputation all to make yet in the talk of the seamen who were to share their life with her. Her name was already on their lips. I had heard it uttered between two thick, red-necked fellows of the semi-nautical type at the Fenchurch Street railway station, where, in those days, the everyday male crowd was attired in jerseys and pilot cloth mostly, and had the air of being more conversant with the times of high water than with the times of the trains. I had noticed that new ship's name on the first page of my morning paper. I had stared at the unfamiliar grouping of its letters, blue on white ground, on the advertisement boards, whenever the train came to a standstill. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.